to the banks, are they your debtors or not?
No, it's just a place that I want to put my money in so they can be safe. An account, so they can be safe.
Instead of putting it
under my mattress.
Now, my question is, on which basis are they taking your money? Because, you know, when the banks started in early ages, they used to charge people. They used to charge people for the security, for the things that they were securing that money. Mm. They were keeping that in the safe. There were some people.
Well, we give a small charge today, too.
They were charging. Mm. But now they do not charge. Not only they do not charge, but they give you on top of that some interest as well.
Right.
Basically, when you're giving this money to that person, it is to keep this in a safe. Whenever I need it, I'll take it back.
Right.
Then why he is giving you some interest?
Because he's using your money.
Technically, this is a loan that you're giving to the banks. It's not investment in the banks. Okay. It's not any kind of, if it was investment, you cannot withdraw. Okay. So basically, you're lending the money to the banks, and they are obviously paying.
So how should we deal with it?
And even in the banks, when we go to the banking system, the central bank or the state bank, it has a law that it puts a certain percentage that these banks cannot use this certain amount of money. Why? Because if in a case a person who has put his money into the bank, they come and they ask for the money, they should be able to pay back. Okay, so basically these are the loans that we are giving to the banks. It is not the investment.
So what is the solution, say?
Okay, the solution
because
is...
Because I think you have an account too, right?
The solution is either you have a current account. On top of that, you know, the question was basically, can we rely on the Sharia Advisory Committee that all banking practices are basically legally...
And where is it located? The Sharia committee.
It's in each bank. They have their own.
Right.
Each bank have its
there
own.
No like,
the Islamic
Sharia
banks.
Committee.
No. The Islamic banks have their own Sharia committee, basically,
right.
Advisory board. So the simple answer is that we cannot rely when they say all the banking activities or the practices are according to the Sharia. Why? Because when we talked about the usury and interest. The professors or the scholars in the Egypt, what they did is they accepted this definition. And when they accepted this definition, that definition that goes to the interest that says reasonable excessive money or reasonable extra money that you take on a loan is allowable if it is by the government. So basically, it contradicts with the verses of the Quran, basically. So, but yes, if that Islamic banking is dealing in different, we can say, like there are different terminologies, like there is a venture, there is a joint venture, for example, there is a partnership, musharaka, we have mudaraba, these are the terms that are used. If they're using that and you're signing these papers by yourself and they're just playing...
Musharaka means to cooperate with
cooperate.
Them, partnership.
Partnership. Basically, the bank becomes a third party. And it basically joins or connects to you with another company. And then it puts your money over there, but they charge something in between because they are the mean to join you. So basically, yes, they can charge in that. Okay, but on top of that, you know that you are dealing with that, for example, XYZ company.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a contract. If you're signing that contract, that is fine.
We need to talk more about this subject, but time's out. Thank you very much, Sayyid, and thank you, dear listeners, for joining us in this program of questions and answers on the Islamic belief. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت اتفاق عندنا وبهذا الحب لنا شامحا.
European News Bulletin.
I'm your host, Saeed Pureza. We'll kick this broadcast off here in England. Calls for getting the shutting down of Napier Barracks in Kent, southeast England, to completion is getting louder, described as the UK's first unofficial refugee camp. Residents say their living conditions are becoming unbearable and social distancing amid a COVID-19 outbreak is practically impossible. Banker Rahimi has visited the camp and sent us this report.
Fake blood being washed away, hours after activists threw it at the gates of the Napier Barracks in Kent, trying to highlight human rights violations taking place here. Security was tighter than usual when we arrived, and the occupants were reluctant to come forward.
Independent organizations, charities, and the residents themselves describe conditions here at the barracks as inhumane and unbearable. This was not what asylum seekers who risked life and limb to get to British shores were expecting. There have been protests, hunger strikes, and suicide attempts.
After an outbreak of COVID-19, morale deteriorated even further. Around 28 people were sharing the same space, toilet and shower, including those who tested positive. Literally trapped, some residents have slept outside in the cold for fear of catching the virus. But the government insists the barracks are COVID-19 compliant. On January 26th, the Secretary of State for the Home Department slapped down Labour MP Zara Sultana for demanding the dignity of the residents be respected and more suitable housing arranged for them.
Because of coronavirus, we need space for social distancing, which has been absolutely in place. These accommodation sites are in line with Public Health England guidance, as we've always checked guidance and to work with PHE throughout coronavirus when it comes to accommodation. I can see the Honourable Lady shaking her head. Perhaps she'd like to listen to the facts and not some of the sort of jaded views that she may hold herself.
That said, less than 24 hours later, dozens of residents were moved out of the barracks with very short notice and taken to a hotel nearby. These men all tested negative for COVID-19, but as they made clear, they were not allowed to exit the building and talk to us, even from a safe distance. There have been reports of them being threatened with delayed responses to their asylum applications if they are too forthcoming with the media. The atmosphere was sober in Kent, and people have mixed feelings towards the asylum seekers.
This is probably going to sound very unkind to say it, but if they left for better conditions here, all right, they may not be what they were expecting, but if they were good enough for the army in the old days, the barracks, why aren't they good enough for them? And that sounds awful, I know, and I'm going to get slated for saying that, but that is my view.
They're people, you know, they're trying to have a better life. Obviously, where they're coming from, the majority of them is horrendous. So I don't know what to do. I really don't know what to do. I mean, I like to think that we're at the end of the day, we're human beings going to try and cope with this as best as we can without blaming people all the time.
I know it's war-torn places and all that, but the law says that the first country they come to, they're supposed to seek asylum. But they're not. They're just coming straight through. This is where they want to get to, because it's easy pickings. We're too easy on them. Sorry, but that's my opinion of it.
In an open letter to the British people in January, the residents of Napier Barracks described their living conditions and called for compassion. These men are finding it increasingly difficult to see light at the end of the tunnel, with asylum applications in limbo and their freedom of movement curtailed even more due to the pandemic. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Brexit was a defining moment in Britain's political history, and a real opportunity, many hoped, of the UK retaking its place as a leading voice on the world stage, free from the constraints of the EU. Now, a month in, has stepping away from Brussels yielded immediate results? Amina Taylor has a closer look.
After years of campaigning, round after round of tough negotiations with the EU, deadlines pushed back and a no deal averted in the nick of time, January the 1st was a moment of triumph for those who both supported the UK's exit from Europe and for those who simply wanted to move on from the diplomatic drama. But flash forward a month into the UK's new relationship with Europe, and even though it's still early days, how's it working out?
Brexit was touted in certain quarters as Britain's Independence Day, a real opportunity to retake sovereignty from the clutches of the European Union. But now, with some time settling in, just what are the realities of Britain's exit from the EU?
Brexit has clearly caused a lot of short-term chaos, basically, particularly with the fisheries exports and with the supply of food into this country. It's been a huge amount of disruption because of the extra red tape. The irony was that the Brexiteers said we are going to lose all these regulations and red tape and we'll be free to do things, whereas in fact there's a whole mountain of stuff that companies have to complete and all has to be correct in order for really the most basic things to happen.
Boris Johnson and his cabinet have been adamant. This is a new dawn for the UK, a genuine opportunity to flex its political muscles on the global stage. Teething problems have dented this bonhomie somewhat, with businesses trading with the EU pointing to new obstacles.
What we haven't been prepared for, and I think this applies to any business in the UK, is all the extra costs that have come from this.
Industries like fisheries have been particularly impacted, with worried businesses taking their grievance directly to Westminster.
Once the customs stuff's done, it's back onto the lorry can then leave, down for the ferry, make sure we got our import declarations done as well, onto the ferry and on the other side. Could be another 30 hours extra for the shellfish in the water. It's not feasible.
The new trade deals that will replace anything lost in the split with Brussels have yet to publicly materialise.
All this nonsense talk about sovereignty and how now we're a free and independent country. On the contrary, we had great protection within the European Union. We were in the biggest trading bloc in the world, which not only meant we could trade freely with them, but also they had clout of the EU negotiating on our behalf and on behalf of the other 27 states for trade deals with other countries in the world. Whereas these days, just imagine what China and indeed the United States will think about Little Britain coming cap in hand.
There have been political complications too, with Scotland pushing ahead stridently for another independence vote as a campaign of reunification is being talked down in Ireland by unionists. Ardent Brexiteers will say moving away from the EU is more than about the nuts and bolts of red tape and temporary obstacles, but about a return to something greater, a renewed sense of pride that you can't put a price on. But for those battling with the new realities, they may well wonder if it's a price worth paying. Amina Taylor, London.
Stay in this country, the UK has added the UAE, Burundi and Rwanda to a list of countries from which all direct passenger flights will be banned. The aim is to stop the spread of a new potentially vaccine-resistant strain of the COVID-19 virus, first identified in South Africa. British, Irish and third country nationals with residence rights in the UK will still be allowed to enter the country but must self-isolate for 10 days on arrival. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has met his Turkish counterpart in Istanbul to discuss a range of issues, including regional stability. The two countries touched on their joint efforts at maintaining peace in the Caucasus and in Syria, and also discussed the potential to work together on the situation in Afghanistan. Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu criticized ongoing Western sanctions on Iran and reiterated Turkey's support for the JCPOA, also known as the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. A new law in Poland that bans abortion is in almost all cases proving controversial. Poland's conservative government, which has strong ties to the country's powerful Catholic Church, supported the ruling, saying an unborn child is a human being. The new law, which came into force Wednesday, will only permit abortions in the case of rape, incest, or threat to the mother's life. Hundreds of pro-choice protesters took to the streets of Warsaw Thursday evening to demonstrate against the law, saying it imposes severe limitations on women's rights and freedoms. At least four people have reportedly been killed in a hospital fire in the Romanian capital, Bucharest. The fire broke out early Friday at the Matei Balz Hospital, where COVID-19 patients are being treated. Vaccinations are also taking place at the same hospital, which had to be completely evacuated. Switzerland is a country which holds regular referendums. However, an upcoming vote on March 7th could see Muslim women banned from wearing the Islamic face veil by law. If successful, the vote would see Switzerland become the latest European country to discriminate against Muslims in law. Robert Carter explains.
Will Switzerland ban the burqa? That is the question being asked by many Swiss Muslims ahead of an upcoming referendum, which seeks a total ban on all face coverings in public. If successful, Muslim women who wear Islamic face veils will be banned from doing so after March the 7th.
Now, the text in the proposal doesn't mention Muslim face veils per se, only stating that no one shall wear face coverings in public spaces. However, the group behind the proposal includes members of right-wing political parties who were behind the already successful bid to ban Islamic minarets from being erected across the country in 2009.
In response, local Muslim activists have begun a Save the Niqab campaign to challenge the hate.
Islamophobia is as spread in Switzerland as everywhere in Europe. We know that there is a realistic chance for the niqab ban to be passed.
Speaking to Press TV, a representative explained why the ban would set a dangerous precedent.
Since the referendum was already signed by more than 100,000 voters to be even admitted to the ballot, and a recent poll suggests that 64% of voters will vote in favor of a ban, the law is highly to be passed. Adding such an Islamophobic and discriminatory ban to the Swiss constitution, which dictates to women how they should dress, exposes Switzerland to internal, or I would say international ridicule, and fundamentally contradicts the liberal and pluralistic values that this country is so fond of propagating. And if we were to ban everything that might been out of force, then we would most likely ban a lot of things, and not only the niqab.
Islamophobia has penetrated deep into Swiss society, with a recent poll finding that 63% of those questioned would vote in favour of a burqa ban, leaving Swiss Muslims with little hope. Robert Carter, London.
Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko has supported Moscow's detention of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny.
All those investigations by this fugitive, who was accepted back in Russia, this German protester, that's just the beginning. And to him, I want to say, if anybody decides to fight, especially against the powers, against the government, against the president, decides to combat corruption, you better be crystal clean yourself.
Western-backed Navalny was detained for violating his parole in an embezzlement case. He is also on trial on assault charges, which he says are politically motivated. In other news, China has announced it'll no longer recognize the British National Overseas Passport as a valid travel document or form of identification. The decision comes amid a bitter feud with London over a plan to allow millions of Hong Kong residents a route to UK residency and eventual citizenship. Under the plan, as many as 5.4 million Hong Kong residents could be eligible to live and work in the UK. Hong Kong is a former British colony, which China reclaimed in 1997.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
It's that time of the broadcast. Outrage and fury at trading services such as Robinhood that have put blocks on trading the shares of U.S.-based retailer GameStop, which has had a meteoric rise to more than $300 per share. The move has drawn the ire of celebrities, entrepreneurs, and politicians such as American Congresswoman AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Ahmed Caballo joins me now to break it down for us. Ahmed, what is this David against Goliath situation?
Yes, David versus Goliath is an apt description. Some are calling this a revolution on Wall Street, the little man fighting back against hedge fund billionaires. And it all centers around something called short selling or shorting, which involves hedge funds betting on stocks that are struggling to lose their value and a way to make money off them. Now, GameStop, which was struggling before the pandemic, was seen as a prime target. However, there was this group called Wall Street Bets, which is on the social media platform Reddit, who have en masse bought the shares of GameStop, forced it to rise up, and basically forced these hedge funds and these billionaires to lose money. And in normal circumstances, they tell us that we live in a free market where all's fair in love and war. But these billionaires have not lied down lightly, and they've used their influence to force 212 Trading app, Robinhood, and a series of other apps to stop you being able to buy this share, meaning and only allowing you to sell, which has obviously caused the price to fall down. Now, it's a bit more complicated than that, but we've got a video from Dave Portney, who is going to explain a bit more.
What is going on Wall Street? The way they have absolutely cheated, stolen, robbed everyday people who have been investing with Robinhood and other E-Trade accounts and all this stuff by saying, hey, hedge funds are getting smoked. Billionaires are getting smoked. So we're no longer going to let you trade on certain stocks, GMC, AMC, NOC. We're just shutting it off. You can't buy those stocks anymore. You can only sell them. We are going to crash those stocks so all our hedge fund billionaire friends can get out and not get killed. It is one of the most remarkable, illegal, shocking robberies in the history, in plain sight.
So basically Robinhood and the like protecting the billionaires.
Protecting the billionaires. And this happened yesterday, and because of the backlash against what Robinhood and these other apps were doing, they were forced today to open limited trades on GameStop. But not everyone agrees. We do have those that represent the interests of the billionaire class that think that what these ordinary people were doing by buying stocks was not right. So let's play that video of someone who's complaining about ordinary people buying stocks and forcing billionaires to lose money.
The New York Stock Exchange does. So if anybody was going to control the listing and shut it down, it should have been them, but it wasn't. It was you. And the reason that they do it is very limited. They do it because they think there's evidence of fraud, or they think that there needs to be a material disclosure by the company that hasn't been made. And that's done to protect the investor. You check none of those boxes here because you don't control the venue. You didn't know about any information that GameStop or any of these other stocks needed to put out. You don't have any reason to believe there's fraud that you've articulated. And you're certainly not protecting these people who've been living the dream of making money, especially at the expense of the big guys. So why should people believe you did this for the right reasons?
Well, we have no choice. We have to comply with all financial requirements. And
the SEC hasn't said you had to do this.
Well, lots of brokers have to...
Good question there. Why should people believe you did this for the right reasons?
Yeah, that was a wrong video. That was actually Christopher Kumi from CNN. He was drilling the Robinhood CEO, Vlad Tenev, about what he's done. And as you could see, he was umming and ahhing, and he didn't really have an explanation for what he did or why he did it. And there is no explanation. There is no justification. It seems like that this was done at the behest of those who have a lot of money and therefore have a lot of influence. Now, we are going to play the video of someone complaining on behalf of the billionaires that we were meant to play a moment ago. Let's play that.
The reason the market is doing what it's doing is
People are sitting at home getting the checks from the government, okay? And this fair share is a concept. It's just a way of attacking wealthy people, and, you know, I think it's inappropriate. We all got to work together and pull together.
If people are trying to make money, he calls it a way of attacking wealthy people.
Yeah, exactly. Now, because of the uproar on social media, this has been one of the number one trending topics for the last 24 hours. We've had some backlash from politicians. We've got this tweet from AOC. She says, "Got to admit, it's really something to see Wall Streeters with a long history of treating our economy as a casino complain about a message board of posters also treating the market as a casino." And some people are mentioning that the 2008 crash was not a result of people on Reddit. It was a result of these hedge fund billionaires who were basically gambling with everyone's future, gambling with people's mortgages, gambling with people's welfare and their livelihoods. Now, Joe McCain says this: "This is how the system is rigged. The elites aren't even trying to hide it. Robin Hood, whose revenue is largely tied to Citadel, restricts trading in GME, AMC, and NOK, which is Nokia. Users can only sell, not buy." Now, this is one of the rumors online. It hasn't been verified yet, but some of these hedge funds, one of them is Citadel, there is allegations they have financial links to some of these apps that have taken this decision to stop trading for these stocks. Now, final tweet from Rep. Jeff Duncan says this: "Tonight, I'm leading a bipartisan group of lawmakers in calling for the SEC to investigate Robinhood and other financial institutions for their unprecedented and harmful actions against individual investors. Wall Street shouldn't get to play by a different set of rules. GME."
This is a story that's going to stay with us for a while, Ahmed, and I'm sure you'll be following it for us. Let's go all the way down under now, and a gang of Australian neo-Nazis threatening to do what neo-Nazis do.
Yeah, so on Australia Day, which is a controversial day celebrated by some Australians of when Australia was quote-unquote found, even though there was already indigenous Aboriginal people living in Australia for thousands of years before the European settlers ever set foot on there. Now, this has caused some outrage because around 30 men burned crosses, called themselves the Australian Ku Klux Klan, made chants about the white race being superior, and it's caused, as you can imagine, a bit of an uproar on social media. But some people are starting to make other points and saying that when a country doesn't come to terms with its own history, When it talks about a day where the indigenous people of Australia were ethnically cleansed, where crimes against humanity were committed against them, where it was essentially an invasion by a European settler colonial entity to take over the land, to take over the resources, when that history is never really acknowledged or taught about in the right way, then of course you're going to get people from that country that think that the white race is superior and that white supremacy is the way forward. Now there have been some tweets condemning these men and what they represent, and some are saying that actually the Christchurch shooter himself was Australian, and that Australia and that part of the world needs to come to terms with a rising threat from the neo-Nazis. So Anti versus Evil says, "Australia, we have a problem. This is a neo-Nazi gathering in regional Victoria. The New Zealand shooter who killed 51 people was an Australian born in Grafton, NSW, and Aussie PM Morrison does nothing." Drew says, "They've always been here, but since the Reclaim Australia days, they've been constantly reinventing themselves, each time denying they are Nazis a little less, till now finally they fully admit it."
Well, Ahmed, we'll have to see what Australian authorities will do about these people. Ahmed Caballo with those stories. Ahmed, thank you. And that's all the time we have for this broadcast. Thanks. Goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio.
website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia repeatedly expressed support for assassinating leading Democrats. A review of hundreds of posts and comments on Greene's Facebook page revealed that, in addition to posting far-right conspiracy theories about the deep state and Democrats, the Georgia congresswoman also engaged with people who called for executing prominent Democratic politicians. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Brett Wilkins, writer. This article is published under the heading, Report Reveals Racist Conspiracy Theories. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene showed support for murdering Democrats. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, a freshman Republican lawmaker, prolific bigot and conspiracy theorist, and a staunch backer of former President Donald Trump, repeatedly showed support online for executing prominent Democrats, including House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, former President Barack Obama, and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, CNN reported recently. Greene, who represents Georgia's 14th congressional district, in January 2019, liked a Facebook comment asserting that a bullet to the head would be quicker to oust Pelosi from the House speakership. In April 2018, she responded to a Facebook post asking, if we get to hang Obama and Clinton over their support for the Iran nuclear deal by saying the stage is being set and players are being put in place. We must be patient, wrote Greene. This must be done perfectly, or liberal judges would let them off. Greene also liked Facebook comments supporting the assassination of FBI agents who were purportedly part of deep state opposition to Trump. Recently, Greene tweeted that fake news CNN is writing yet another hit piece on me focusing my time before running for political office. Over the years, I've had teams of people manage my pages, she wrote. Many posts have been liked, many posts have been shared. Some did not represent my views, especially the ones that CNN is about to spread across the internet. Greene's views, however, have been clearly on display in recent years. These include, but are not limited to, the following. Being a vocal supporter of conspiracy theories including Pizzagate and QAnon, which allege in part that prominent Democrats are leaders of a satanic cult of cannibalistic pedophile sex traffickers seeking to destroy Trump. Agreeing that massacres including those at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut
Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, and a mosque in Christchurch, New Zealand were false flag operations meant to erode Second Amendment rights. Expressing anti-Semitic and Islamophobic views, expressing anti-black and white supremacist views, including the opinion that the most mistreated group of people in the United States today are white males, espousing 9/11 truther conspiracies, and finally claiming that Clinton has murdered her political enemies. An incessant twitter of lies and conspiracy theories, Green, who won 74.7% of the vote in her 2020 House race, is also known for menacing Democrats in Congress, including the so-called Squad. While campaigning last year, Green posted an image of her holding a gun alongside Squad members, with a caption reading, "We need strong conservative Christians to go on the offense against these socialists who want to rip our country apart." Green was one of the 147 Republican lawmakers who attempt to overturn President Joe Biden's Electoral College victory, helping to incite the deadly January 6th pro-Trump terror attack on the U.S. Capitol. Squad member Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who took refuge in a secure room with maskless coronavirus-spreading Republican lawmakers, including Green, during the Capitol siege, said afterwards that she had feared for her life due to QAnon and white supremacist sympathizers, and frankly, white supremacist members of Congress in that extraction point who I know and who I had felt would disclose my location, who would create opportunities to allow me to be hurt, kidnapped, unquote.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Salamun alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss the problems and questions parents have regarding Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are mostly based on the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Rishari. And in the studio with us is our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad, an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Almiyah of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Miqdad. Thanks for coming to the program.
Wa alaikum salam, rahmatullah. The pleasure is all mine.
So the question that we've received today is from a wife who says that her husband wants to raise their children as a single child in the family, and she wants to convince him otherwise. The question basically is, I'm not sure if it's a good idea to have only a single child in the family or with many siblings. So this is happening also because of the economy. Parents are afraid of the financial burden that children will put on them. And so the notion of having only single children is growing in some areas. It's not necessarily a bad idea, but there might be some drawbacks to this and some advantages. The question basically is, what are the drawbacks and what are the advantages?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, only child is a phenomenon in today's world and unfortunately affecting many Muslim parents and Muslim families. It's something we need to relook into very seriously, because especially in today's world, I mean, if this discussion wasn't important perhaps, although it was, but let's assume it wasn't important many years ago, in today's world with modern challenges and modern society and the environment that we're surrounded with, there's actually even more relevance in this topic that we need to discuss it. And actually the point of having many children is even more relevant today than any other time. Interestingly, the Holy Prophet of Allah in Hadith number 29 in our book says that, increase your children, for tomorrow I will boast of your abundance over other nations. And we have many other hadiths as well that talk about the importance of having many children. For instance, the next hadith, Hadith number 30 in Al-Kafi, Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam says that, talking about what Yusuf said to his brother, he says, my father commanded me saying that if you are able to have an offspring who will add to the value of the land by glorifying Allah, then do so. And there's many negative consequences, and as I mentioned in today's time, the relevance of this. So many negative consequences of having a lone child, which I like to talk about in this show, and to really bring awareness to this idea that only child is not a positive thing at all, and we need to have many children, close in age, and having a big family, basically.
Some parents argue that these narrations are related to times when the strength of a tribe or a country dependent heavily on how many men they had to fight in wars. Nowadays, a country, to function properly, doesn't need so many human beings. I mean, there's a limit. And shouldn't we consider that limit when we're deciding how many children we want to have?
So the last hadith that I mentioned, none of the hadiths I mentioned talked about that, especially on the point about having boys only, because we have had the hadith that talk about raising girls and the amazing blessings of raising girls. But the last hadith actually told us that if a child will add value to the land by glorifying Allah, then do so, have more children. In other words, take it this way, that Allah wants to, Allah's mercy is unlimited, right? And Allah's mercy should reach as many creation as possible. And therefore, we need to increase the number of creation out there. We can be the cause for this mercy of Allah to reach other beings. I mean, it is through us as parents, by increasing many children, that we're actually allowing these children to benefit from the mercy of Allah. So no, it doesn't go back to any of those points that you raised. On the contrary, it has a more deeper understanding of why we need to have big families.
Okay, let's take a short break and we'll be back for this discussion after the break.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam said, seek and ask for a child, for it is the source of comfort and happiness of the heart.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about having only one child, the single child policy, if you will. And before the break, Brother Maghdad iterated some narrations that insisted on having as many children as possible that would glorify God subhanahu wa ta'ala. And just before the break, you said that God's mercy is unlimited, and it's better for us to be the cause for more beings to receive this mercy. Some people will say, well, what if I'm bringing my child into a miserable, poor life, a life of poverty? I'm not actually serving that child. I'm only putting that child in a very tough situation that he has to endure for 8 or 9 decades.
So let's do this. Let's talk about the ideal situation. Let's talk about a normal situation, okay, where we have a parent, a couple who live a normal life. Okay, they have a job, or he has a job, and they have a house to live. They have all the possibilities. Let's talk about that situation and talk about having a big family and that in that particular circumstance. And then once we've done that, we've made what should be the ideal situation, which we're here to claim that it should be a big family. Okay, I don't want to give a number to how many children or what the age span should be between them. Whatever is counted as a big family, it can be two, three, four, five children, as long as not a lone child. Obviously, the more the merrier, I'd like to say. And then after that, if we want, we'll come back to those questions that are related to specific situations where, for example, you're living in a situation where financial stability is very weak, or, for example, in a situation where the country law doesn't prevent it, or the environment doesn't prevent it, or, I don't know, parents from both this, any of the side, for example, have different circumstances that could lead, for example, for us to go away from this rule, right? But first, just establish the rule. The rule that we want to put across out there is that ideally you want to have many children.
Or should we say that ideally you want to have as many children as possible?
Yes.
Can we talk about some of the disadvantages of raising a single child?
Right. So I'm not going to go in any particular order. I'm going to mention many points about this. So firstly is that a child that is a lone child in a family, that is a single child in a family, this child will have not be able to, will not have this happiness that comes from playing with other children of their age. I don't know if you have these images in your head about whether from movies, from cartoons, or from real life about the older generation, where you have this family with five, six, seven kids, and you see how happy they are together, how every child has got a space in the house and they're playing together. This is something that I remember going to the park back home, and you see this parent coming with a child and they're holding the child, this lone child, all alone. He's going to go down the swing. And then
no one to play with.
No one to play with. It's a very miserable scene to be.
Very depressing. Okay, let's go to a break and we'll be back to talk more about that.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5 years old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this estrave to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. English Radio at irib.ir.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic upbringing. We're talking about raising single children and having only one child in the family. Just before the break, you said that one of the disadvantages is that the children are always lonely. They go to the park, they're playing all alone. Well, what if the family provides a society for them of children, like them going to classes, or children of other families? So this child is being raised in his house alone, but outside of his house, he always has friends. Will that not compensate for siblings?
So first point regarding this is that if it's possible to do it, then perhaps, okay? In most cases, it's not possible, because at the end of the day, children spend most of the time at home, okay? If you say they'll go at school, they start school at 6. Well, what about before that? You're going to put them into nursery, you're going to put them into preschool from the age of 3 to 4. This comes at its own expense, right? It's going to be expensive. Who's the teacher going to be? What kind of things they're going to learn? There's so many different negative consequences that will come from this. And all of that just because you wanted to have a lone child, right? So this is the first point, that first is very, very unlikely. Secondly, if you do this, send them to a society out there very early, it comes with a lot of negative consequences from the influence that they'll receive from the teacher, from the other children, etc. And the next point is that at the end of the day, whatever relationship you will have with other friends and other colleagues at school, it never matches what a brother and a sister will do, right? The joy and the fun that you get by playing with your own brothers and sisters, right? I mean, it's very different from the fun you get by playing with friends that will come and go in your life, that will be temporary, that you don't understand fully 100%. It's different from your brother and sister that you live together and you do everything together. You're under one roof. You know them very well. The playing and the happiness and the joy that comes from that is very different.
We have approximately a minute. Can we squeeze in another disadvantage?
In the same light of what we talked about before is social skills are not learned or are very weak in children that grew up as lone child, as an only child. When you have brothers and sisters, there's a lot of skills that you learn that are related to social skills, right? You're fighting with your brother and sister. Then you have to forgive and forget. You have to be able to talk to your children, convince your brother or sister. You have to convince them to do a particular thing. There's a huge level of social skill that is learned. And add to that is the whole baggage of emotional intelligence that will build when a child is actually dealing with brothers and sisters, right? Different age, different wants and likes and desires in the house. And all of that leads to challenges that come by living together under one roof. And this really brings about a huge level of emotional intelligence, of social skills that won't be learned anywhere else.
Thank you, Brother Mighdad. It's always a joy talking with you. And thanks, special thanks to our audience out there for whom we are here for. And we hope you enjoy these programs. If you missed our program, don't worry. You can always download an archive of this episode and all our previous episodes from our website. Simply visit www.parstoday.com. That's parstoday.com. And find our page on Call of Islam Radio. You can also email us at englishradio@irib.ir. That's englishradio@irib.ir. Until next episode, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.